We'll do a quick overview of the parasha. This week we will learn Matot en Masei. The word Mateh means a staff, it means a tribe. just like Shevet means a staff and a tribe, right? So the leaders are given the instructions of the laws of vows. There are different types of vows a person can take. There's the concept of a neder, where a person can take a vow and he can make something prohibited on himself, like a sacrifice. A person can dedicate an animal for a sacrifice. A person can deprive himself of any benefit from any other person. He can say, any benefit you try to give me should be prohibited on me like a sacrifice. A person can take on a good custom, and then it can take on the form of a vow. So we have many laws about that. We have laws within a marriage where women were more prone to this. Today it's not a fad, which is good, because it wasn't a good fad. But for many, many generations, women would take vows all the time. I swear that, da-da-da-da-da. So the Torah gives a special leniency for women that they don't have to go all the way to the rabbi to get their vow annulled. There's a way they could do it with their husband. In order to promote family peace and unity, the Torah gives women this leniency. If the guy makes a vow and he regrets it, he has to go all the way to the court. He has to go all the way to the rabbi to find a way out. But the woman has a special leniency that her husband can help her get out of it, as we will learn when we learn more depth. We're up to Sheni. The Torah then tells us how Hashem commanded Moshe to take revenge from Midian, and then he will pass away. So instead of postponing it, Moshe right away forms an army, 1,000 people from each tribe, and they attack the Midianites, and surprise, surprise, they win, they conquer all of Midian. That was not what they were expecting. And they destroy the 5 kings of Midian, they come back with all the loot, and they're all defiled from the war. Moshe and the Kohen Gadol Elazar go out and they review the laws of purity with them. But then they see that there are women with them. They say, what's going on here? This whole war began because of these women that came here to cause the Jews to sin. What'd you bring them back for? They're the main part of the war. So you can't leave them alive. These are the women that came here to cause us to sin. Because of them, 24,000 men died. And then they go over the laws of purity and they also teach them the laws of how to kasher, how to take a vessel that was used with non-kosher food and make it kosher, and the laws of how to make a vessel usable by a Jew, meaning when a Jew acquires or receives a vessel that's used in the preparation of food items, so it has to go to mikvah. It has to become purified after you purchase it, after it comes into your possession. So we go through those laws. That brings us to Revi. Then we have the whole deal with how they took off a tax, how much they gave to the Kohanim, to etc. And at the end of the parasha, we have the story of the tribe of Reuven and God come forward and say, this whole section on the eastern side of the Jordan is so lush, we want it for our cattle. Let us settle here. And Moshe says, what are you doing? You have the land of Israel before you. Why would you want to stay here? You're scared? So you're going to cause everyone to get scared, and then you won't go into the land. What are you doing? This is how we messed up last time. So they say, we're not scared. We'll go and conquer with them. But we have a lot of cattle, so it makes sense for us to have this part of the territory. It's huge territory, and we want this for our cattle. And Hashem says to Moshe, fine, but you have to teach them that that's not the way to work. You don't look at your cattle and decide where you're going to live. You look at your kids and decide where you're going to live. And tell them first to think about their children and then to think about their cattle. And then you can make a deal with them. And from these details, we learn about how you make a deal, how you make conditions and stipulations in halacha. And the details of that we'll discuss at greater length. And we have the description of how the eastern side of the Jordan was divided. And finally, we reach the last parsha in the book of Bamidbar, Parshat Maaseh, which begins with a description of the travelings of Israel, which is very important, because by denoting where exactly we traveled for 40 years, the Torah is revealing to us one of the greatest miracles of all time, how a nation of 2 million people existed in the desert. If you wouldn't have this parasha, you could assume maybe we traveled in places where there was food and ample water, oases. For 2 million people, it's a little far-fetched, but still, maybe you could convince yourself. The Torah purposely gives a record of where we traveled, and until the Rambam's time, they knew where these places were, and the Torah is telling you, go and check. You'll see that no nation could last in such territory. And that's why the Torah takes the time up to Shlishi and Parashat Maaseh to give us all the details of our travelings. The Jews are commanded, when you come into the land of Israel, get rid of all the idols. And then you will divide the land based on the sizes of the tribe. And then the Torah goes into the borders of the land of Israel. How you figure out where exactly the land of Israel, what are the borders? What's in and what's out? And then we have the description of the Levite cities. And we're up to Shishi. We're at the end of the parasha. We have the mitzvah of Ir Miklat. If a person kills by mistake, unintentionally. So the Torah says it's not like it was beyond his control. It was not gross negligence, but it wasn't completely beyond his control. So he has to go into exile. He has to go to one of these cities of refuge. And so we have the laws of the cities of refuge. And then at the end of the parasha, we have the story of the daughters of Tzlafchad, where the tribe complained if they have an inheritance, lots of the land of Israel, so then when they marry, their husband is from a different tribe, and their children will be from a different tribe, and then we'll lose that section from the land of Israel. So Hashem says, it's a good point, let them marry within the tribe. And the end of our parasha is the marriage of the five daughters of Tzlafchad. And that's our parasha. So, Matot en Maseh. Now let's review it with more depth. When we look at the parashiyot, so you notice that this week we read two parashas. Why? Because next week is the last Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. And our sages instituted that certain Torah readings have to be read in certain weeks of the calendar. And so Chazal wanted that on the week before Tisha B'Av, the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, we would always read the parasha of Devarim. Because in the parasha of Devarim, there's a pasuk, Eicha Esa Levadi. How can I carry you all alone, Moshe says. And we read that in the tune of Lamentations. Eicha Esa Levadi. How can I carry alone? You burden me so much. And that's an allusion to the Megillah of Lamentations, to Eicha. So we always read that the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. In order to be up to that next week, we have to read two parashiyot this week. So we have a tradition, we put together Matot and Maseh this week, we'll read it together. Now we begin the laws of vows. So we know there are two types of vows, right? What are the two types of vows? Neder and Shvua. Does anyone know what the difference is?
Neder changes the law because it's an object, and Shvua is just the obligation upon the person itself.
Beautiful. Shvua is about me. It's all about you. You take a vow. I will eat the sandwich today. I won't eat the sandwich today. I'll climb Everest this year. You take a vow about yourself. Neder is about the object. This watch will be prohibited on me like a sacrifice. Okay, that's it. I can't enjoy the watch anymore. Neder is more focused on the object. It's not a perfect definition, but that's the general definition we use. When you learn Nedarim and Shavuos, you'll see there are exceptions to the rule. But the general approach is that. So neder is, this animal is hereby an Ola sacrifice. Okay, the animal's dedicated. It's holy. I can't use it anymore. Where else do we encounter neder? So let's talk about minhag a little bit, okay? So those of you who are chozrim b'tshuva or geirim, you don't yet have a minhag. As you study more, you will have to decide which minhag you take upon yourself. In certain areas of minhagim, a person can go and do hatarat nedarim. So let's discuss hatarat nedarim for a minute, and then we'll come back to minhag, okay? The Torah reveals to us that a person cannot go against their own vow. And if you do go against your own vow, it's destructive to the whole world. Because what you say in a vow is you're saying, believe me, because I tell you by the honor of God, I'm not lying to you. So you're putting God into the picture. You're saying, if I'm lying, that's because I have no respect for God. So by the honor of God, I want you to believe me. So that's the definition of a vow. And that's why a vow is so weighty. It's one of the Ten Commandments. Give me a few minutes, okay? So when we speak about a vow, a vow in halacha is one of the weightiest things you can do. And we stay away from it. There's a story about Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's father. He headed a gemach. Okay? So he used to have money that he'd give on loan. And he was the public rep in that fund. So there was once a time where the public funds were low. And someone had a halachic dispute with him about whether he returned the money to the public fund or he did not. And they took it to court, and Rav Salant, who was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, he said, well, Rabbi Orbach, if we want to believe you, but you have to take a vow. You're going to put your hand on a Torah scroll and swear by Hashem's name that the story happened the way you said. And Rabbi Orbach said, this is Rav Shlomo Zalman's father, he said, I'll pay the money. He said, what do you mean? You're in the right. Technically, if you take the vow, then you win the court case. And he said, right, and I don't want to make money off of the usage of Hashem's name. I don't want to take the vow. I'll pay the money out of pocket. It was a large amount of money. You'll see in a minute. So Rav Salant said, I'm sorry, I can't let you do that. Because you're the public rep of the fund, if you back out of taking the vow, then the fund will lose its reputation. You have a responsibility to the fund. If you don't take the vow, then people will say, ah, you see, he pocketed the money. And if word gets out that way, then you've ruined the fund. People need the fund. You're helping a lot of people with this fund. I need you to take the vow, and I can't let you opt out. And so he forced Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's father that he has to take the vow. He said, if you know you're telling the truth, take the vow, because we have to move forward, and the money is yours. The funds, not his personally. So his father fasted for a long time, and he prepared himself, and then the day came, and he came to the court, and he took the vow. And years later, they found in Jerusalem a synagogue that had a room which had a plaque on it that said, this room was dedicated by someone who does not want to be known under any circumstances. And that room was actually donated by Shlomo Zalman's father, who said, I have to repay. I benefited monetarily from the usage of God's name. So I have to repay that money to Hashem. And even though Rav Shlomo Zalman grew up in such poverty that when they received the refrigerator, they were the only refrigerator in their neighborhood. The refrigerator housed everyone's food. It wasn't their refrigerator. It was the community's refrigerator. And Rav Shlomo Zalman used to say that as a child, he would go to school without breakfast. He had many days where he had to fight the gnawing pains of hunger, which was common in Jerusalem at the time. As he forced himself to study. And nonetheless, his father skimped pennies year after year until he was able to pay back that money. The Talmud tells us there was a woman who had given money as a loan, received the money back, and forgot. And then she had to take a vow. Now, that money had fallen out of her apron into the dough that she made. And so she made bread and sold it or something, and they never discovered the money. And then she was told she has to take a vow that she never got any benefit from the money. So she took a vow. By Hashem's name, I swear, I never got benefit from that money. Well, she did, because there was a certain volume of dough she didn't have to bake when she baked it. And the Talmud says she lost all her children. Her children died in her lifetime. And the Talmud gives us that story to illustrate the gravity of taking a vow. People were warned. The whole world suffers if a person takes a false vow, because what you're basically doing is you're saying, I am talking to you, believe me, by God's honor. And Hashem says, oh, you're bringing me into the picture? Well, okay, I'll check. Are you right? Are you accurate? If you're bringing me into the picture, fine, I'm in. So we stay away from vows. In Shulchan Aruch it says, if a person took on a vow, and then he kept the vow, it's as though he erected an altar in a prohibited state and brought a sacrifice in a prohibitive state. So you think, I brought a sacrifice, great. No, you're not allowed to. You don't have a temple now. What are you doing, building an altar and bringing a sacrifice? So you did something which can be perceived as pious, but it really isn't. And that's why it says, if a person took on a vow, let him go to a rabbi, because we have this concept of hatarat nedarim, where a rabbi will interview the person and try to figure out with him if there is a technicality, if there is a loophole with which we can annul the vow. Sometimes a person takes on a vow, and the person says, I swear I won't eat meat this week, okay? And then his in-laws show up, and they bring venison with them. So he says, gee, when I took the vow, I didn't know I'd have venison. Never ate venison before in my life. So you say, okay, when you took on the vow, there were details that you did not take into account that you now know, and a rabbi who has learned the halachot can work out with the person and very often find a technical legal loophole to annul the vow. Where we say, you took the vow, but you didn't really understand what you were doing. So it's a slightly complex area of halacha. But that's the concept of hatarat nedarim, where by going to a rabbi, to someone who's learned these halachot, a person can sometimes annul the vow that he's taken. But generally we say, don't take vows. Okay, so that's, in a nutshell, the concept of a neder and a shvua. We'll go into a few more details, but first, Daniel, yeah. Hatarat nedarim? OK. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. Good question. Yes? So there are many terms that can be used. That's a good question. The wording of a neder and shvua can affect whether it's a correct neder or shvua or not. That's true.
Also, if someone said, I'll be there tomorrow,
okay, so why do people say bli neder? So we have a concept that if a person accepts upon himself to do a mitzvah, then that can sometimes take on the legalized form of a neder. Being that you should do a mitzvah anyways, if you say, I'll do the mitzvah, so then it's as though you've taken on a vow to do the mitzvah. That's why people are careful to say, bli neder. The Talmud says, if a person would like to say in advance, any vow that I might take on in the next year should be annulled, he can do that. And that's why we do hatarat nedarim on just before Yom Kippur, or before Rosh Hashanah. What we're saying is a declaration. We want to annul any vows that we might take on from now on. If someone didn't get to do it yet this year, you get three adults and you make this declaration in front of them. I want to make a declaration. Now, from now on, any vow that I'll take on should be annulled. And that takes effect. That's So that's why we do that. There are more reasons why we do that. That's in a nutshell. Yes? Oh, you got to speak up.
The fact that we say bli neder is just in case we break it, right? Does that not just render a word, a sentence, or I will, superfluous anyway? In other words, no point saying I will do something. Tomorrow will come to you and ask bli neder. There's no point. You should say I will try. I'm saying.
Okay, that's true.
Okay, we don't say bli neder, but it is a neder because we said I will. I'm saying.
Both points are true. It's true that a person should teach himself to speak in more reserved tones,
yeah,
instead of saying "I will," to say "I will try." And it's also true that it's a good habit to say "bli neder" on many things because you could run into it. Sometimes it's foolish. Can you pass me the soup? Bli neder, I will. No, that's come on, pass him the soup. and the fact that you said "bli neder" doesn't make it permissible to lie. And you have to keep your word. You said you're going to do something, do it. The fact that you said bli neder is completely irrelevant. Bli neder means I didn't take a vow, but I still have to keep my word. We have to be people of truth.
Well, bli neder, maybe someone thinks he's going to forget.
Then he should write it down. Or he should say, if I remember.
Okay.
We have to be truthful people.
Okay, that's
good. Okay. Generally, we stay away from taking on vows. An area where this comes up is sometimes in the area of tzedakah. You go to shul, you're bidding for an aliyah. I had a rough surprise. I went to a shul, I was there for the first time. They're bidding for an aliyah, and I hear 2, 3. So I said 4, and the next guy said 5. So I said 6. The next guy said 7, and we ended up at 12 or 14. So I figure 14 shekels, not a lot of money. And the guy says, sold to the guest for $14. And I'm thinking, I'm in Israel, $14? I thought I was bidding 14 shekel. Okay, you just quadrupled my donation. Okay, I didn't know they were bidding in dollars. I'm lucky it wasn't in thousands, right? It's still 4 times what I was planning on bidding for an aliyah. What was worse was that someone else went up for the aliyah instead of me. No, so then who says I have to pay, right? Okay, but coming back to the story, I went up and someone else went up, so I wanted to catch him after davening and ask him, are you planning on paying that, you know, whatever. Okay, at any rate, this does come up. If you bid for an aliyah and shul, you're basically taking a vow. You're going to give that donation. When you get an aliyah and in the Mishaberach, they say, bavur sheiten. So when a person says, I will do a mitzvah, or I will give charity, and even if a person just thinks it as decisive, this will go to charity, then he is obligated to do that. So we have to get into the habit of not deciding. Meaning very often we'll have clothing that the kids won't use. And my wife will ask me, should we give this to this person that we know that needs, or that person that we know that needs? And we forced ourselves to get into the habit that we don't obligate ourselves. We say, we will try. Because if you decide, I will give this to that person, so you've just obligated that. You've obligated this to that donation. When it comes to specifically Hekdesh and Tzedakah, when you decide, I will give X amount of money or X amount of goods to this good cause, so we have the concept Amirato Legavoa, saying that I will give something over to heaven, which heaven doesn't literally mean heaven, right? Kimsirato Le'ediot has the same halachic weight as though I already gave it over to someone else. Just like if I already gave it to the guy, I can't take it back. Once I've decided I'm going to give it, I can't take it back either. So it's good to get into the habit not to decide, to think I want to give, I intend to give, not I've decided I will give. But if you've decided, then keep your decision. Okay, so our parsha gives us the leniency of hafarat nedarim. Hafarat nedarim is a technicality. A husband sitting at home, and he tells his wife, when are you going to shower already? And she says, what are you nagging me to shower for? And he says, well, you haven't showered in 3 days. And she says, I swear I'm not showering till next year. And he looks at her and he says, it's not even up yet. Okay, so the halacha says, if she takes a vow about something that pertains to him. So he has, our Torah says, he has the following leniency. He has that daylight period, that day, to be mefer. He can say, I hereby annul your vow. They don't have to go to the rabbi. He can say, I annul it. What happens if he tells her, good, don't shower. Just stay away from me. You're not showering, okay? Until Tishrei, the shower is all mine, right? Okay, the halacha says that at that moment, he upheld her vow. Once he upheld her vow, even if 5 minutes later he regrets it, he cannot annul it anymore. Now she is just like him. They have to go to a rabbi and see if there's room to annul the vow. So long as he didn't uphold the vow, he can annul the vow that day before the sun sets. So long as he didn't uphold it, he can annul it that day. What happens if the next day he chooses to annul it? Too late. Go to the rabbi, see if there's a way out. What vows can he annul? Vows that are relevant to him. If she takes a vow and says, I swear from now on I will only cut my toenails on Tuesday at 12:30 in the afternoon. Okay, she took a vow. What does it affect him? You know, she got to figure out how to cut her toenails at 12:30 in the afternoon on Tuesdays. But it doesn't affect him. So there are things that when it affects him, then he can annul it. That's called hafarat nedarim. Now, when a rabbi figures out a loophole, a technicality to annul a vow, he uproots the vow from the beginning. It's like the vow never existed because you found the technicality to annul it retroactively. When a husband annuls the vow, he only annuls it from that moment onward. So she took a vow, I'm not going to shower. She may not shower. If he annuls it 2 hours later, from that moment onward, she may shower. But she cannot retroactively. If she did shower, she sinned. It doesn't help her. Just a second, he's waiting, sorry. Yes?
I've got a technical question. What if the husband is a rabbi? And
so let him ask his local Orthodox rabbi. Okay, yes?
What if the wife makes her vow pertinent to the husband at night? So it's the next following night? Or?
Right. Okay, now we have two more interesting details in the halacha, and then we'll move on. Ah, yes, Alexander. He doesn't have to do what she wants. He can annul the vow because he wants, not because she wants.
Okay, so if he annuls it, then what's the obligation?
There is no obligation.
She cannot divorce him.
They're back to square one. There's no vow. They're the same way they were before him.
In other words, she just doesn't have to go through with it.
Correct.
Tomorrow, decide.
Correct.
She's not obligated to not do it.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
There are two interesting points here. We have point one is what happens if the husband says, good, don't shower. And then the next day he tells her, I'm annulling your vow. Technically what he did doesn't work. So she goes and showers. He told her it's annulled. Torah says he will carry the weight of that transgression. And the Torah is giving us an insight here. That you guys, as husbands, have a halachic responsibility to understand the halacha. And when you don't know to verify the halacha, your wives are going to rely on you. Her husband tells her it's annulled. She went and showered. Okay, so what do you want from her? He told her it's annulled. She believed him. He should have known better. So the Torah teaches us an important halakha with regards to our responsibility of knowing halakha within a marriage. That's point number one. Point number two is, the Gemara says, the Torah says, what happens if she says, I swear I'm not showering till next year? And he hears her. And he says, really? That's what you want? Interesting. Walks into the other room, walks into his study and says, I'm annulling that vow. And he doesn't tell her. And he walks out and she says, did you annul the vow? And he says, I'm not telling. And she says, okay, I'm going to shower. And she goes to shower. And an hour later, he tells her, yeah, I annulled the vow. Torah says she has to do tshuva. Because when she took the shower, she did not know that she wasn't sinning. Technically, there was no vow, but she did not know that. And when you do an action and you don't know that what you're doing is kosher, that's also called a transgression. And there are many applications to this. You know, a guy goes to a store and he asks, is there a hechsher? And they give him this funny answer. Don't you see we have rabbis in the pictures on the wall? Don't you trust us? And he goes and he eats there. And he has no clue whether what he's eating is kosher or not. So then afterwards, it might turn out everything was kosher, but he didn't know that. So when you do something, if you don't know, then the fact that it works out okay doesn't mean it wasn't a transgression. The woman didn't know. A guy, there are many applications to this where sometimes we say, it's probably okay. Well, even if it is okay, that's not the point. If you did an action that theoretically could have been wrong, like what she did, she didn't know if he annulled it or not. And even though technically what she did was okay, but that doesn't make it halachically okay. She wasn't intending to do what was right. She was intending to do what she wanted. And, you know, a guy goes to a party and drinks. Then he says, I think I can make it home okay. He has no right to get behind that wheel. And when he gets home and he's okay, he still sinned. What he did was dead wrong, excuse the pun, getting behind that wheel when he wasn't 100% sure that he was with it. So people say, but I made it okay. That means nothing. The action was still a transgressful action. Yes? Ephraim, you wanted something?
Yeah. This, with the woman of transgressions, this only applies, I assume, like it's a transgression to Bidei Shemayim.
Right.
Because you can't say, like, you can't attempt to murder someone and then...
Right.
Or shoot them and not kill
them. I didn't hear?
I said, like, you can't attempt to murder someone, but then not successfully kill them and still be threat of murder.
Right. Okay, so Hashem tells Moshe, take the Jewish people's revenge from the Midianites. Moshe tells the Jews, take God's revenge from the Midianites. Moshe says to Hashem, what are you saying? It's our revenge. If we'd be pagans like them, they wouldn't pick fights with us. The only reason people hate the Jews is because we're Hashem's people. It's Hashem's war against the Midianites. Hashem tells Moshe, after that, you're going to die. So Moshe could have said to himself, gee, if I just postpone the war, I'll live forever, right? That's what Yoshua did. Hashem told him, divide the land of Israel and then you'll die. So Yoshua said, why should I die so fast? So he took his time conquering the land of Israel. And he should have lived to the age of 120. And Hashem said, because you did that, you will die 10 years earlier. And he died at the age of 110. But Moshe does the exact opposite. Hashem told him, fight the war and then you'll die. And Moshe right away tells the people, I need 1,000 people from each tribe. No one wanted to go. They heard Moshe was going to die after this war. No one wanted to go. And they had to force the soldiers to go. They took 3,000 men from each tribe. They had 12,000, meaning 1,000 from each tribe that everyone knew was clean, hadn't sinned with the Moabite women. These were pure holy tzaddikim, and they could go to war to avenge what had happened with the Midianite women. They had another 1,000 to keep an eye on the camp, to protect all their belongings as they went to war. And they took a 3,000 men, one man for each person at war, to pray for him. They had a corresponding Jew praying for the Jew at war. And we did this in the last few battles that the Jewish Saul went to war. People were given out names. The rabbinate of the army gave out names, and every person got a name of a soldier they were praying for, they were doing mitzvot for while the soldier was at war. We've been doing this now here in Israel. Ever since Castlet, I think, at Sukkot Tan. So Moshe sends them for an excursion, so to speak, to attack the Midianites. And unexpectedly, they have tremendous success, and they conquer all of Midian. And these men are so pious, they're careful never to be caught alone. Because the way nations would go to war is their women would get all dressed up, so as to seduce the soldiers of the opposing army. And the men knew they didn't want to be tempted. So they all went in, and a miracle happened. They came back, and no one died at war. They didn't lose a single soldier, which is unnatural. And from here we learn that it's to be expected, even when you're doing a mitzvah and going to war, the people will die. It's a part of war. This was considered an extraordinary miracle that they came back and no one had died. And about these soldiers, King Solomon says in the Song of Songs, "Shinayich ke'eder ha-ketzuvot sha'alu min ha-rochza." Your teeth are like a bunch of sheep that come out of the bathing. They're so clean. Nothing was wrong with them. None of them deserve to die. 1,000 men go into war. 1,000 men come out of war. Yeah.
It's a natural thing to die, to expect people to die in war. Then how come when the 36 or however many people died in the Battle of Ai, how come they assumed automatically it was a phenomenon that they did die and something hadn't happened?
I don't know. I asked that question and I don't know the answer. You're right. You're right. I don't know the answer to that. But do me a favor, when you find out, tell me. I don't know. I agree. I agree. It could be because the spies had told them by Ai that the city of Ai would be so easy to capture that they didn't expect to suffer casualties. But I think your question is better than my answer. I'm not happy with the answer. I don't know. That's where the Minchas Chinuch proves that conquering the land of Israel overrides Pikuach Nefesh. That was the big discussion in the Oslo agreements. Do you say that Pikuach Nefesh would allow us to give up lands of Israel? So the Minchas Chinuch writes, you see, people are supposed, it's a natural thing. You have to expect people will die at war, and yet you do go to war to conquer the land of Israel. So you see that conquering the land of Israel overrides Pikuach Nefesh. That was the big discussion back then. Okay, they come back, and they have all this loot, and they have the women with them, and Moshe and Elazar come out, and Moshe gets upset, and he says to the leaders, what'd you bring back the women for? We went to war because of these women. And because Moshe gets angry, he forgets the halacha. They need guidance as to how to prepare the vessels and how to purify themselves and the vessels, and Moshe can't teach them. He got upset. And from here, our sages teach us a rule. When a person gets upset, if he's a prophet, he loses his prophecy. If he's a wise man, he loses his wisdom. If he's a regular person, he loses his sanity. When a person gets upset, he loses it. And whatever level he's on, he gets knocked down. It's not forever, but you lose it. And this also teaches us an important rule about anger. People say, I got angry, I saw red. No, you had a split second when you chose whether to get angry or not. There is that moment of decision where a person decides, I will see red. I will lose it. Afterwards, he might lose control, but he let himself lose control. We have to hold on to control at that second. And Moshe gets upset, and he loses it. He loses his prophecy. Now he's upset over a mitzvah. He says, what'd you bring the women for? These are the women who caused people to die. They brought the women back, and people were pointing. People were saying, you see her? Shmerel and Beryl and Yankel all slept with her and they died. She's still walking around alive. So the camp was looking out at these women and they recognized them and people were talking. Moshe says, you brought them back to us? What'd you do? So Moshe was upset. We can understand that. But nonetheless, he lost his prophecy. He lost his understanding of halacha. And Elazar gives the class that day. He teaches them the laws of how to prepare vessels that were purchased from a non-Jew. Our sages say Elazar didn't get Moshe's permission before he started teaching the class. Moshe was stumped. He was upset and he couldn't teach the class. Elazar started teaching, and because of that, Elazar is never mentioned again. He's only mentioned once as the Kohen Gadol by Yoshua, but you don't find him teaching Torah again. You don't find him leading the people again because he taught in the presence of his teacher without asking permission. So, What halachos do we learn here? So the first thing we learn is kiboleo kach poleto, when you purchase something that was used with non-kosher items. Okay, so let's say you buy a grill, you buy an oven, you buy a pot, and any of these you buy from a non-Jew where you can assume they used it with non-kosher food. So we have two issues. Issue number one is maybe there's grease, maybe there's grime, maybe there's leftover food. You know, maybe there's edible, maybe there's edible grease there. So you got to clean it. Number one is the items have to be clean. So you clean, okay. Number two, we say, that's what the Torah teaches us here, that an item that's used in heat absorbs from the flavor of the food that it's used with. So if, let's say, you have a spit, you use it to roast your turkey. So if you're roasting turkey that wasn't shechted, so even though turkey is a kosher bird, but if it wasn't slaughtered properly, it's not kosher. Or your roasted animals that were not slaughtered properly. A and P meat. Okay, bottom line, it's not kosher. So now, during the process of roasting it, the spit absorbed from the flavor of the animal. So that's issue number one. You buy a grill. Again, the grill absorbs from the grate of the grill absorbs from the flavor of the animal. So how do we kosher it? We take burning hot coals and we put them over. We put them down on the different parts of the vessel, and that's how we kosher it. And that burns the flavor on the walls, being that it was absorbed through direct heat. So we put it back in direct heat by putting burning coals, red hot coals on it. That's called libun. Libun is that I've, so to speak, whitened it. I've made it red hot, white hot. Sparks could come out of it in their types of metals. Our metals don't usually emit sparks. So that's libun. Next we have kli rishon. Let's say I have a pot. So the pot has water. I boil water. In that water I cook non-kosher meat. Now I want to kosher the pot. What do I do, number one? I clean it. We always wait 24 hours because we say the first 24 hours, the flavor that comes out is positive flavor. After 24 hours, it's not positive flavor. So when we're going to kosher a vessel with hag'ala, with boiling water inside, we wait 24 hours. Next, what we do is we take a bigger pot, and we put this pot into a bigger pot, a pot that's bigger than it, because we say, usually the pot overflows. And even if you're going to make this pot overflow, today it'll overflow on the left, and yesterday it overflowed on the right. So it absorbs flavor as you cook non-kosher meat inside, or meat and milk inside, right? How many people cook, there's this thing where they put in yogurt, and then they cook the chicken in the yogurt. Okay, that's not kosher, right? So your pot absorbed meat and milk mixed together, right? So now you want to kosher it, you clean it, you wait 24 hours, or if you know it's had a 24-hour period since its last usage, and then you put it in a pot that's bigger than itself, that way the water envelops it all around, then you boil it. So that's, in a nutshell, we have the concept kiboleo, the same way it absorbed, kach poleto, that's how it emits its flavor. Now, some items are powerful enough that you could put them to a blowtorch. Most things we have today cannot handle a blowtorch. Where do we run into this? A frying pan. You buy a non-kosher frying pan, 99% of the time you cannot kosher it. Because when you use a frying pan, very often there's no more liquid left. Frying pans today are almost always coated with Teflon. If you put Teflon to a fire, it'll melt. You'll destroy the pot, so there's nothing to talk about. So a Teflon frying pan very often cannot be kashered. There will be exceptions. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Same thing with the grilled cheese maker. I had a friend, he had a grilled cheese maker. He had guests. They didn't realize it was milchik. They went and made themselves a steak on the grilled cheese. They thought it was a George Foreman, right? So he has milk, grease all over, cheese grease from his kids' grilled cheese sandwiches. And these guys didn't catch that that's what's going on. So they took a slab of meat, they put it in his grilled cheese maker, boom, closed it shut on the grilled cheese maker. Now what do you have? You have meat and slobby grease. Okay, you could say the grease isn't edible, but it's a milchi grilled cheese maker that just absorbed meat. You got a problem. You can't really kosher it. Because if you try to kosher it, the walls will melt. Okay, so in each instance, you'll ask your local Orthodox rabbi, but bottom line, this is the idea. When we have heat, it absorbs. Where do we have cold items absorbing? Two exceptions to the rule. Number one, if we have vinegar, if we have a sharp liquid, and we put something in it overnight, so then we say the sharp liquid will also cause it to absorb. That's called kavush kimbushal. When something is sitting and it's marinating in something sharp, so that it can absorb and emit flavor as though it was cooked in it. And the other exception is davar charif, when we have a sharp item. So let's say I have an onion, I have a garlic, and I cut it with a meat knife. The knife is clean, okay? I use this knife to cut my steaks. I haven't had steak in about 4 years. Now I use the knife to cut a garlic. We say because the garlic or the onion is sharp, it will pull out the flavor from the knife, even though it's cold. And that's why you have to have a power of knife at home, so that when you cut onion and garlic and lemon, when you cut sharp foods, you cut them with a pair of knife, because otherwise you got to keep track. I cut this onion with a fleishik knife. I cut that onion with a milchik knife. I can't put the milchik onion in a fleishik pot or the fleishik onion in a milchik pot. So we always cut sharp foods, sharp flavored foods, we cut them with a pair of knife. That's why you need a pair of knife at home. Same thing with the cutting board. You should have a pair of cutting board, because the blade cutting down on the sharp item, so we try to do that only on a pair of cutting board, not on fleishik or milchik. Till here we're all together. Okay, we're covering a lot of ground today. Yes. No. Okay. Tvilas kelim. So the Torah says when you purchase a food vessel, a vessel that's used in the manufacturing of food. So that includes a knife, a fork, a spoon, let's say, the grate on which you put into the oven and you put your challahs on, right? You put bread on. Any item that's used to make food that's made out of the following material, right? It has to be made out of one of the metals or made out of glass. Glass is rabbinic. What if it's made out of earthenware? Does not need tefillah. What if it's made out of wood? Does not need tefillah. What if it's made out of plastic? Does not need tefillah. But if it's made out of one of the metals or glass, or if it's glazed, so then it requires tefillah. You purchase a vessel that's used for the manufacturing of food. So
glazed
cheres we tevil without a blessing because the glaze is glass. Yeah.
I have something.
So when you get a chance, tevil it. Lechatchila, we do not use an item before we've tevilled it. When you tevil a vessel, you clean it well. You take it to a mikveh. You make the blessing al tevilat kelim and you tevil it. You should not tevil vessels in a mikveh that's used for people's immersing because you might just break glass in there. Not a good idea. So we have a custom. We don't toivel vessels in a mikveh that people use for immersing themselves. There's a separate mikveh we toivel our vessels in. So any vessel that's used for the manufacturing of food, that comes in contact with the food, that was purchased from a non-Jew has to be toiveled. We received for our wedding a hot water urn. And the hot water urn is made of metal. And it's used to heat up the water, right? So I titled it, and it got destroyed. And most of the time, they do not get destroyed if you leave them out to dry correctly, which I did not do. I titled it on a Friday, and I wanted to use it for that Shabbos. And there goes the hot water urn. It was an urn. Kumkum also, after you title it, put it out in the sun to dry for 2 weeks, then it'll dry. If you do it, you like I did it for like 6 hours, so then it might go on you. So the next time I bought a hot water urn, I decided I'm concerned. So I went to a person who was not Jewish, and I said to him, "Do you want to buy this from me?" So he said, "No." So I said, "Fine, I understand that. But what do you say we make a deal? I'll give you 10 shekel. I'll give you 2 5-shekel pieces. And then you'll buy this urn from me. I bought it for 45 shekel. It was like an electric tea kettle. I bought it for 45 shekel. And you could buy it in the store for 45 shekel. But I'll sell it to you for 80 shekel. But the deal is like this. You pay me 5 shekel. And I keep the urn until you come up with the other 80 shekel. I'll give you 10 now. You give me back 5. So you've paid 5 shekel for the urn. It's yours. But it's staying in my house till you finish paying the other 80. We both know he's not going to pay the other 80 because he could buy a new one for 40, for 45, right? He made 5 shekel, but the urn is legally his, right? Technically, legally, it's his. He bought it from me. He just has to finish paying for it. So I gave him the urn. He paid for it. He gave me 5 shekel. And then I said, okay, if you ever want to pay the other 80, until then I'm using it. If you ever pay the other 80, you could. It's yours now, but it's staying in my house till you pay the other 80. So that was our deal. And that way, legally, it was his. And I didn't, when I have a non-Jew's vessel in my house, I don't have to worry about titling it. There's a big machlokas about whether I have a problem using vessels that were not toveled, which are not mine. You go to a restaurant, you go to an event, you go to your parents' house, they didn't tovel their kalim. So you have dishes that were not toveled. Rav Moshe Feinstein holds, you're not supposed to use those vessels, but there are other opinions that say you may, and I recommend you rely on those opinions. Don't make your lives more difficult. There are opinions that say the responsibility is on the owner. It's not my responsibility. Just because I'm using his vessels doesn't make it my responsibility. Yes, guys? So that's an important leniency to rely on. No. Sometimes you know. I was at someone's house and the kid comes over and whispers to me and he says, none of my parents' dishes were titled. So I took the kid aside and I said, then why don't we make a trip, you and I, and we title all your parents' dishes? We did that. We waited till they were all out of work, and we took all their dishes. We took 2 hours, and we went and titled all the dishes. And then we washed them, and dried them, and put them all back, and they didn't know it, but now all the dishes they use for the rest of their lives and they are titled. How long does it take? 2 hours, 2.5 hours. Okay, he did his parents a tremendous service. It's a lot of work. Okay. Okay, the tribe of Reuven and Gad are attracted to money. which is a good reason to leave Israel. It seems like there was always this temptation. Let me go to Chutz Laaretz to make money. There's so much money, you know. That, you know what they call the United States? The land flowing with filth and money. That's the code, right? So it's been tempting people forever. And we see what happened. The tribe of Reuven and Gad hid a lot of murderers. On the eastern side of the Jordan, there was a huge problem of education. There was a huge problem of murder. And they were the first to be exiled and banished from the Jewish people. And on the short term, they gained. They had a territory that was almost the size of all of the land of Israel. They had a huge territory, so big that Moshe asked, who volunteers to join them? I need more people here. And two families from the tribe of Manasseh joined. That's how big that territory was. They couldn't even cover all of it. And they were powerful warriors. The tribe of Gad used to have a swoop with the blade that they'd cut off a person's shoulder and head in one hack. Wow. They were so powerful, v'taraf zeroaf kodkod. When they'd come with the sword, they'd cut a person diagonally, and the enemy would be left sliced in half, you know, head and shoulders, head and shoulder. Yeah. So they weren't scared to be on the eastern side of the Jordan, but realistically they lost. Forever they lost. They lost the education of their kids, they lost the connection to the Jewish people, and this is a temptation that our generation has to contend with. Meaning it's very, very tempting to think about money. And Moshe comes back to them and says, your kids first. Don't think about the money first. We'll deal with the money. You have to deal with the money. But you got to first think about your kids when you think about where you're going to live. And they make an error that they pay for with the future of the tribes. They're lost. Meaning the tribe lost over and over again throughout Jewish history to the point where they were ultimately banished. Our parsha ends with the story of Shiduchim. And a quick line, it's a nice joke that people say, but there's truth to it. Like many a true saying has been said in jest, right? The daughters of Tzlafchat couldn't find the Shidduch, right? They're already older girls, and they're big tzaddikot. The Torah tells us they were very pious women, and they couldn't find the Shidduch. So the end of the parsha, the end of the book of Bamidbar, tells us that their tribe came and complained. They said, they'll marry into another tribe, and then their children will be from another tribe, and will lose the whole that section of land that's theirs. Will go over to their kids when they die, and then we'll lose it from our tribe. So Moshe says, he turns to Hashem, and Hashem says, they're right. And so he tells the five daughters of Tzlafchad, you have to marry within the tribe. Next pasuk says they all married their cousins. So people like to say, wait a second. Why were they older spinsters? They had those cousins around for years. Why didn't they marry them beforehand? So they say like this. Before Moshe came along, they thought they could marry anyone in Israel. When you have a lot to choose from, it's hard to choose. When Moshe came back and said, you got to marry within your tribe, okay, then my cousin's good enough. Sometimes it's important to limit your scope. Sometimes there's a male malady where a person thinks, I can do better. Why should I settle for her? I can do even better. And that's why many people never get engaged their whole life. Many people never get married their whole life because there's always that feeling, hey, she's okay, she's good, but maybe I can do better. Comes Moshe and says, look within this box, look at your tribe and see who's right for you. And suddenly they say, hey, our cousins are great for us. And they get married. Shabbat Shalom.